With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Guest who's joined us many times, but it's been a little bit of time, Dr. Joseph Lee from Hazleton. Multiple questions for him on opioids in the news every single day here in this city, here in the state, all across the country. Dr. Lee with some interesting thoughts. We'll get to the doctor in about 30 minutes or so. Let me ask you guys this question. So I'm walking here today, and in front of me, like 50 feet away, I see woman, I'm guessing late 20s, early 30s, pregnant, fit, and smoking a cigarette. Pregnant, fit, and smoking a cigarette. And I kind of thought, should that stand out to me? I mean, if Darryl was here, Darryl would probably go back to, because when people have brought up, you know, don't ever drink, Darryl thinks that's total nonsense. She's not saying, you know, get drunk every night, but her point is the occasional glass of wine will do nothing. When did the tide turn on this, Adam? Because there was a point for a long, long time in this country where I don't think people would look and be alerted in any way if they saw a pregnant woman smoking. But don't you think now it does stand out? Would it stand out to you if you saw somebody right now, pregnant, and they were smoking?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's much different than having a drink being pregnant. I think you're doing much more damage smoking.
Because most of the time, so this is about 9:45 or so.
Yeah.
The idea that you're having the occasional smoke and you're just having that occasional smoke at 9:45, yeah, I'm not eliminating it. But to me, that's a regular smoker. Now, how many? I have no idea. Lindsay, what do you think? If you see somebody ballpark your age, in shape too, and having a heater while pregnant, what do you think?
Oh, I'm judging hard. This isn't one of those things where you're like, oh, she's wearing white pants after Labor Day. Like, this is someone else's life is in your hands and you're being incredibly careless. Like, sure, you're not guaranteed that something bad is going to happen to your child.
So for decades, when people did this, forever, until I don't know when, but it was going on all the time. Were they all careless?
We knew less than we did then.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a fair assumption to say, sure, people smoked for decades. You know, Adam makes the comment all the time about, oh, they drove around without car seats and, you know, they were back of the pickup truck or...
Different voice for Adam this time from the 12 o'clock hour, too.
I was giving him a little bit more credit.
Yeah.
No, but it's just we know too much now in 2017 for you to be that careless.
Selfish. I mean, if you... And I understand that it is a terrible addiction and it is very... And it's...
Unbelievably powerful.
Incredibly powerful.
And it's interesting how people who have not faced it can lecture and I know people who have tried and tried mm-hmm. and tried, and they were diligent. I know others who tried once. Common's on the air right now. Common's story is he just on his own stopped.
Yep.
Right? I believe him 100%.
So did my mom.
Yeah. I mean,
cold turkey.
That's the rarity.
Yep.
Right?
She smoked when she was pregnant with me and both are.
Explains a lot.
Yeah, right.
Explains many things.
But if you're going to get pregnant, I mean, you've got it.
Any scenario, you would say something. Don't know the person at all.
It depends how that person is like flaunting it somehow. Then I'd probably say something. But
Dan, any scenario?
Like you're talking about the scenario where you're running into some random individual on the street? No, of course you don't say anything. I mean, does anybody not know that smoking is supposed to be harmful to pregnancy? Is anybody? I mean, you're not imparting information to this person they don't already have. Why would they? Why, you know, if they've made this choice, they've already considered it and made this choice. What are you going to do that's going to influence them?
You're next to them in a place, and it's rare now, where a few people are smoking. It's allowed, but most people don't. And you're sitting next to someone, next to the table. Mm-hmm. She's smoking. Is there any scenario where you just say, really? What are you doing?
No, because I think to do something like that isn't about actually trying to assist that person. It's trying to make you feel superior and better. You know, look at me. I know you're not supposed to do that. Because, again, this person doesn't know you at all. Why would they – why would whatever you have to say all of a sudden flip a switch with them and go, oh, wait, I really shouldn't do this?
Any
they already know.
That you'd say something.
No, because unfortunately, I think for a lot of people, being shamed pushes you to do that more. Like if I said something, I'm sitting next to Dan and Dan's smoking a cigarette. Obviously, he's not pregnant. But if I even just said something like, what are you doing? What? Why do you do that? That's so gross. That shame, that sign that I find it gross, just encourages that behavior.
That would be good pub for the show. If you could get pregnant.
I was going to say, if I was pregnant, yeah.
I'll give you $500 for that.
Oh, will you?
Adam, are you in for $500 out of your own pocket if Dan will get pregnant for the show?
I can't afford that.
Lindsay, how much money for you out of your own
I'll
pocket?
I'll babysit for free.
What? Forever?
That's pretty good, actually.
That's pretty good. Text in 81807, 2 points. How much money would give Dan if he gets pregnant and the scenario I laid out? Among the texts on the issue of a younger pregnant woman smoking and your reaction to it. You are not the health police. What do you do when they're eating McDonald's? Both legal substances. Funny thing, it's none of your business. By fit, you mean thin. She was thin because she smokes. You didn't know she's fit because she's thin. In this case, she was also strong. And I mean, I guess to me, when I brought that up, I thought, here's someone who is health conscious in that way. And she wasn't just thin. She, I mean, sculpted and strong and healthy looking, not inordinately thin. Another one. Moms that smoke should lose their baby. And understand what it'd be like. Very sad. Yeah, that would be a pretty dramatic stance, don't you think?
It's a little harsh.
Yeah, to say, okay, I know you're pregnant, and we're going to keep this going, but after delivery, because you smoke, you're going to lose the kid. The story about the student loans and the amount of people who might get a break and the amount of money is an amazing story. Tens of thousands of people who took out private loans to pay for college. They haven't been keeping up their payments, but they may get their debt wiped out because paperwork is missing. These loans, have you been paying attention to this story, Carter? Because I'm only paid a little bit until I saw another story today. You know how much they total? $5 billion. Legal battles going on. Judges have dismissed dozens of lawsuits against former students. A review of the court records. New York Times says that many other collection cases are deeply flawed with the ownership records. Some of the problems are playing out in a $108 billion, I repeat, private student loan market that for some people is reminiscent of the subprime mortgage crisis a decade ago. So you got some of the largest owners of these private student loans. They're struggling to prove to the court that it is the legal paperwork to show ownership of the loans, which were allegedly made by banks. So they now have an umbrella name for these 15 trusts involved in this that hold 800,000 private student loans totaling $12 billion. More than $5 billion of default is in debt, according to court filings. The trust aggressively pursued borrowers who fell behind on their bills. They brought at least four new collection cases each day. Judges throughout the country have tossed out the lawsuits, ruling that it did not prove it owned the debt on which it is trying to collect. How would you like to be in that position, Adam, where you're, I mean, what's kind of a standard now? I mean, I guess there isn't a standard, but I mean, what do you hear? You hear numbers anywhere from 20,000 to 200,000, and you're behind. And, Adam, you took this on expecting the responsibility that you would have to pay it or you would have to deal with the penalties. And now because how this is transferred back and forth, that they can't find the paperwork and that up to $5 billion might be wiped away. You going to feel just fine with that? I mean, that's...
Not if I'm one of the students whose paperwork didn't get lost, but yeah. I still have to pay my loans back.
Right.
And Schlubby McGee over here, who went to, I went to school with, did worse in school. I'm not talking about you. I thought you were looking at me like, what?
You looked right at Lindsay and called her Schlubby. Is that an inappropriate thing like,
can
to
you say that to a
coworker?
Hey, Schlubby, why don't you take the
hey,
stairs?
Schlubby.
Why don't you take the stairs? And do you go to church? What the heck? No, but I mean, if you're.
What,
you've got $20,000 in loans.
Yeah.
And Schlubby's paperwork got lost and he doesn't have
again,
to pay.
Looking at Lindsay. I don't know why.
I said he.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it would not be.
Now calling Lindsay a man, just to add to it. Can you call a female coworker he? Lindsay, I think what you'd have to do at this point is not pay for a little bit and find out if they've lost your paperwork.
Yeah, that,
unless you just, you know, believe in ethics and you want to keep paying.
Is there
could
a
have
list?
Negative consequence, like, too. You could, but it hurts your credit report.
But, I mean, wouldn't you be tempted?
And the number of people, what do they say? The number of defaulted student loans right now is just astronomical.
Crazy.
These people, if you've defaulted on your student loan, you don't care about your credit score because it's already ruined. So do you take the chance that you're the one in a million shot that they lost it?
Not even one in a million anymore, right?
Well, it would feel like one in a million. If someone called you one morning and was like, I'm sorry,
I don't think so. It's 800,000 private student loans. It's $5 billion.
It's crazy.
If you work one of these private groups, again, I know the ethical thing to do is what, Dan? You're paying. Okay? But if you're broke, you don't have a job yet, and you're seeing your friends Schlubby and Chubby, and they're not paying...
Or your name is Kyle Sheely.
Yeah. Sheely is trying to get involved in this transaction in some way.
I'm with Dan that it could come back at some point and be bad if you don't pay.
Dan hasn't even talked yet.
Yeah, he did.
No, he didn't.
I agree with Schlubby.
Schlubby!
Were you not the one who said defaulting?
No,
he hasn't said a thing.
This is literally the first time I've turned on my microphone in this conversation.
Oh, my God. What am I on?
Schlubby, come on.
It's in that can.
Maybe it was at. Okay.
What am I on?
One of the men in the room said.
When are we getting? What is he
he's
on?
He's been on vacation.
Remy?
Yeah.
Come on, Remy. Let's call him
somewhere.
Okay,
so not going off of what Dan said, but going off of the fact that if you don't. Do you take the risk and you don't pay? I'd work out some deal and just get like all the interest wiped away. Like I'll pay the money that I took out.
Oh, so you're negotiating right now. But what if they say, hey, Schlubby, we have your paperwork. So
no,
good luck
to
you.
No, they don't have it is my point.
If they don't have it, you're still going to pay?
Well,
they can't prove it. Adam, if they can't prove it through the paperwork and the courts have said no paperwork, nothing, are you still going to pay? No,
no.
Way. I'm out. Dan, come on. If they can't prove it,
I don't know,
and they don't have the paperwork, and the courts have said no paperwork, nothing, are you still going to pay?
I'd certainly think about it because that's where karma comes into play for me. When you start trying to take advantage and game in a system like that, something, piano's going to fall on your head. Something's going to happen.
See, I knew what he was going to say.
Yeah. Remy's right there. And I saw him last week here many times.
I guess he's on vacation.
We'll be talking to Schlubby during the break. Speaking of a backpedal, you know, I really think this person's a decent person that tells another story. No, he's awful.
Well, you could be a good person and inconsiderate, right? I mean, those aren't mutually exclusive.
Yes, that's true, but I think Adam did take it a little bit further
he used
than that.
A term I can't use on the air, but...
Yes. Okay, back to smoking here. A version of the story came out, I think it was about a week ago. But now there's another look. So I think it's worth talking about where smoking in movies, okay, and ratings and what's going on. So you've had different studies out there about how much smoking is taking place. There's a group called Breathe California Sacramento. They keep track of tobacco incidents in all movies that spend at least 1 week in the top 10 grossing for any week during the year. They assess each movie. So they looked at movies from 2010 to 2016 with a G, PG, or PG-3 rating. They would say that the good news is that smoking's making fewer appearances. 2010, 31% of movies with youth-friendly ratings had at least one tobacco incident. And that's, so that's 10. Now in 16, it's 26%. But tobacco appeared on screen in fewer PG-13 movies over time. The total number of those appearances actually rose. The study's authors noted another problem. Efforts to keep tobacco out of movies that aimed at kids appear to be faltering. Since 2010, there's been no progress reducing the total number of tobacco incidents in youth-related movies. We've had outlets for a long, long time, Adam. I think there's one out of, I think it's Salt Lake City, it's for sure Utah, where they try to sanitize movies. They try to take movies, and it's not just taking out swear words, but it's smoking, it's drinking, and they'll do that. And I think, hey, unless everybody, unless the powers be with that movie say, okay, no way are you allowed to do that. You that's someone's piece of art. You don't get to sculpt it in that manner. To say there is an impression through art, through entertainment, through athletes, through other adults in their life to kids, that's naive. But how much do movies have to pay attention to this about the message it is sending to younger individuals? Because I'm sorry, I don't want to see more kids smoking. And we should point out now St. Louis Park has joined Edina. And we talked about this. Edina's policy would work if more cities picked up on it. Well, one of the cities right next to them, which in theory could have said, hey, we're going to make more money. They said, we're on board. The people who write and direct and produce these movies and put them together, they get to put together the characters they want. And Adam, I'm sorry. If they decide that the Adam Carter movie with Schlubby includes somebody who smokes and they want to make Schlubby a smoker, they don't have to worry about the 8-year-old kid in Crystal who's going to see that as cool.
Right. I mean, to a degree. I mean, it depends what kind of movie you're making and what your target audience is. I mean, if you're making a movie that's directed at preteens or teenagers, I think it would be a little irresponsible to
characters. So we're not
First of all, it's kind of outdated talking about movies. I'm thinking more about TV shows.
Well, you can talk about YouTube. And if we're talking about the
because it seems like, it's the period pieces, right, where we see the smoking happening, like Mad Men. Think of Mad Men and how many.
Oh, there are plenty of movies. There are plenty of movies that feature current stuff where they show people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. But
yeah. But, okay, again, if it's all of a sudden, because we're going to get another Lion King soon. If Simba's having or Mufasa's having a heater.
hanging out of his mouth.
You know, that's a bit of a problem. But if you make a PG-13 movie.
Yeah, which emojis are smoking, and then I want to go see it.
Yeah, you know. But if you make a PG-13 movie where there's cross-appeal, are you saying that they can have characters who smoke? Because plenty of teenagers are going to want to see it, plus adults are going to like it. Where's the line? I don't think they have to be self-conscious. Now, some are going to say, Dan, they're not really being self-conscious, but they've made this decision to enhance the character in this way, and can't you find other ways to portray this person without also showing them smoking a cigarette?
Or just, ask yourself the question as you're preparing the scene, writing the scene, whatever you're doing, is the smoking that I've put in this scene absolutely necessary? Right? Does it significantly change this characterization if this person's smoking versus this person's not smoking?
Does the bar have to be that high? Absolutely necessary.
I'm not saying to draw like a firm and hard line. I'm saying it's worth having that thought experiment, right? It's worth thinking through that. That's, I think, where we're trying to get to is we know that smoking in media, in movies and in television has an impact on kids.
Yep.
On a PG-13 movie, if that's what we're aiming for, there's going to be kids, under the age of 18, obviously, going to this movie. Is this something that, because there are situations clearly where smoking means something, having a character smoke means something.
Because that can be subjective, too, on how much
That's the thing. That's why I don't think you can draw a hard and fast line. I think what we want to be doing is encouraging people to just have that thought. Okay, is this something that adds? Is this something that's just there? Is this something if I took it out, the scene wouldn't change at all?
I think I'm concerned by a card or two because I think Dan makes some very good points. And I get it. To act like there isn't an influence, it's just fraudulent. But to be talking about entertainment and the role on a piece of art where in their mind, individuals, male or female, get to create the scene, the storyline, the character, to say now, as a 37-year-old person, they have to wonder about how the 14-year-old watching this movie is going to react. I'm not sure I want to go that far on PG-13 movies. Out on R movies. I'm sorry. I'm out.
Yeah,
where's the line where somebody's putting something together has to say this could have an effect on a certain amount of kids?
I mean, you got to weigh that with, okay, do it. Like Dan was saying, I mean, is it really essential to the story to have this character smoke? And whether is somebody going to walk away from the movie saying, geez, you know, that was a really good movie, but I can't believe this more people weren't smoking. That I would have enjoyed it more. I mean, a perfect example.
You say about drinking, too.
A perfect example, I think, is Wonder Woman. That's a movie with broad appeal.
Thanks for spoiling for me now. Wonder Woman loves her cigarettes. Great.
But it's a broad appeal set against the backdrop of World War One, where there's a heck of a lot of smoking going on.
Another spoiler.
And I don't remember any characters smoking in that movie, unless maybe I just don't remember.
Maybe anything. You smoked before and don't remember all the details.
I took my kids. Come on.
Oh, seriously. Lindsay? How cognizant should people in entertainment be when they write something that has cross appeal, teenagers and adults, about smoking and drinking and other things that adults do, but it can leave an impression on younger people?
It's such a gray area, and it all comes down to parental responsibility. I hate to say that, but it does. Like, whatever your child's being exposed to, at the end of the day, you're the one who's kind of the deciding factor of how far it goes.
Most of the time. Because when they start getting 14, 15, 16, 17, they're on their own many times and they're exposed to a lot of these things without you just standing right next to you.
Yeah, but if I'm a 14-year-old and I get, you know, pulled over, you know, walking down the street smoking a cigarette, I'm not going to say, oh, I saw this TV show last night and it sure looked really great. No, I probably took the cigarette from my parents' car.
34 past 2 on CCO. Number of times over the years, we've been fortunate enough to chat with Dr. Joseph Lee from the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation on so many different issues. You think of what we discuss so many times on this show and what comes up all the time in this country. Maybe it's a personal experience. Maybe it's your exposure to the media. It is the opioid crisis. And recently, Dr. Lee was a part of this Hazelden Betty Ford Institute for Recovery. Their advocacy's Emerging Drug Trends Report for the month of June. They worked in collaboration with the University of Maryland School of Public Health. Saw a story about this and thought of Dr. Lee and thought it made sense to reach out to him. Always a pleasure, sir. Thank you very much for your time. I know in reading a couple stories about this, one of the points you wanted to make in this unbelievable crisis that is taking place, the differences in the individuals who can be vulnerable to this, who maybe can deal with it on a regular basis. And maybe the idea is we're not emphasizing the different individuals as opposed to the power of the drugs themselves. Is that a somewhat fair assessment? And just elaborate a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So it's good to be on with you again. I think this is a really important message. You know, when the history books get written about the opioid crisis, we'll all be mourning the toll it's taken on the country. But I'm afraid that we're all going to have takeaways about drugs. And the truth is that in years to come, there will be other drug epidemics and other lives will be lost. And right now, we're so focused on the drugs and what to do about the drugs. And those are very important conversations, of course. But there are millions of kids incubating in schools right now that we needed to be doing prevention services for. But since we're not focusing on people, since all we talk about is drugs, we're not making investments in the right way. So when it comes to prescribing opioids or how we treat addiction or how we even do prevention services, we really need to reset our attitudes and perspectives on what addiction is really about, what substance use is really about. And it's about people, not drugs.
So what can we do with individuals when they're fairly young to provide them with the right tools so they don't get caught up in this horrible swirl?
Well, the beautiful thing about helping people and investing in people is that you don't have to talk about drugs specifically at a young age. By teaching empathy skills, communication skills, and other kind of social skills, pro-social skills, we call them in scientific literature, you can actually help some kids who are at high risk mitigate that risk as they get older. And we know that we can pick out the highest risk kids when they're in grade school, early in grade school, years before they use any substance at all. They show psychological concerns, and then the research says that those individuals, some of them, not all of them, will go on to develop serious substance use disorders. And that's how we need to make investments. But the way we treat addiction is we wait until people have problems. And in the doctor's office, this also becomes a problem because we have this pendulum that's very polarized and it swings and it goes from pain is undertreated 20 years ago and everyone's prescribing opioids to if you now ask for a pain medication, then, you know, pain medications are the devil. And if you are asking for pain medication, then you're a bad person. And we have this polarizing conversation instead of saying we're different. We're all different. It's almost like if somebody goes to a fast food restaurant, we all acknowledge fast food is bad, but can't we also talk about the people, that not everybody gains weight the same way when people eat French fries, that some people eat fast food more than others. And we have this silly dialogue in society about Taco Hut versus Burger World instead of who are these people that are going, and we're really missing the boat with that.
So let me go back to the idea of kids very young and in elementary school.
Yeah.
How would we do this? And then you know this better than I. If all of a sudden somebody has a 7-year-old boy or girl and they've faced these questions, what are the process would be, and you tell us about this, and all of a sudden you reach out to the parents somehow through a phone call or meeting and say, we think your child is predisposed to having vulnerability towards this 5, 10, 15 years down the line. How do you think most parents are going to react to that when it's just a 6 or 7-year-old kid they're dealing with?
Well, the great news is that usually not 6 or 7, but when they start to hit adolescence, parents kind of know this in their bones. They have these concerns. I can't tell you the number of parents that come to us. It's actually very rare that we have to alert parents to a warning sign. It's usually the parents have some concern, and when I lay it forth, they have a lot of intuitive sense about their own child. They also know their own family history of addiction. And so this is not something that surprises a lot of parents out of the blue. And when you see these kids who are at risk, you're not lecturing to them about just don't do drugs. You certainly do some education, but you're actually building what I talked about is pro-social skills, empathic capacity, empathic decision-making, good communication skills. Because what you're really doing is building psychological tools so that when these psychologically vulnerable young individuals grow up, they have another way out and they have another way of dealing with their problems.
So now we're dealing with folks right now, most people who are listening to us who never faced this when they're younger, so they don't know. And they have some sort of significant pain, whether it's a surgery or whatever it might be, and they first, for medical reasons, are introduced to this. How should they find out now at this point if they're more vulnerable to this before they start taking this, which is at this time under this hypothetical is medically prescribed to them and there's nothing out of the ordinary about this prescription?
Yeah, well, surprisingly, or not surprisingly, a lot of people actually are prescribed opioids, take them just as prescribed, and use it for the purpose, and they're not at major significant risk, and so they do perfectly fine. In some individuals where they kind of say, you know, I have a lot of alcoholism in my family, or there were substance use disorders in my family, and I have to be a little more careful, I would urge them to do a self-appraisal, to look at their other behaviors. Do they smoke cigarettes? Have they gotten carried away with other things before? And then let their provider know beforehand, before a procedure, that, hey, I know this is an injury and I may need it, but, you know, you might want to supervise this, and I just want to let you know that this is kind of what's going on. And then on the healthcare side, there's a lot of work that has to be done because we don't do enough screening and risk stratification for the individuals. The way the doctors think is if your knee pain is legitimate, yeah, and you check out as a sort of nice guy, then I'm going to prescribe for you. And that's not what the science says. The science says that that a lot of these individuals who are prescribed opioids are also prescribed Adderall or also prescribed Klonopin, you know, because it makes sense that people who eat at Burger World a lot also go to Taco Hut. more than other people who don't go to Burger World, if you follow my analogy.
Sure.
So you're actually seeing that these people in hospital systems can be found out. And some hospital systems have been very proactive. And so in the medical records, if you prescribe a benzodiazepine or a pain medication, you'll get a flag saying, hey, this person's also on this, this, and this, because people are starting to synthesize the data and finding out that you can find these high-risk individuals and you can help. And that means that you might screen more with them. That means you might talk to them more. That means that you may supervise their intake of certain substances more, may intervene earlier if you see warning signs. And so there's a risk stratification that can be done in the healthcare organizations. Some healthcare organizations are doing it, but we have a long ways to go before we have the right kind of dialogue on this problem.
Dr. Joseph Lee with us, Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation. So again, we're talking people. Let's talk doctors. Okay. You know this, again, 1,000% better than I. The research has showed us some doctors are more inclined to prescribe more medicine, that they will acknowledge what's going on. They're not sticking their head in the sand, but they still continue. This is the way to go. Others are less inclined. So we're dealing with people. The doctors are playing an enormous part of this. How do we try to, and we're trying to condition and adjust all people involved in this situation, how do we try to locate those doctors? How do we try to make doctors more aware of this?
Yeah, so a lot of doctors actually are very conscientious about it and are very concerned about where they're prescribing and where it's going. So I'd say that's actually the majority of doctors. And those are the doctors that are checking the prescription drug monitoring website that we have in the state. But it's sometimes we have some, you know, problematic doctors in every state, and they don't really check those websites, and they're not really in the choir, so to speak. And so there has to be education for them that I think is mandatory about, you know, what these prescriptions can do. And then I think there has to be some accountability for that. But we also have to have a healthcare infrastructure in hospitals, and that's everything from, how much time physicians have to assess patients. If you're seeing, you know, 4, 5, 6 patients an hour, sometimes these conversations are very hard to have. So they need a lot of support. So doctors could do a lot better. I know that we've certainly overprescribed, and I'm not minimizing that at all. But to just say that's the smoking gun without saying we need a larger conversation is really an error. I mean, look back to, like, in college, the kind of advice that you'd give to people who had too many bad nights, you know, drinking alcohol or going out, you know, and everybody still assumes that alcohol affects everybody the same way. So then you tell your buddies, well, just do this or eat a fried egg and then you won't have a hangover, and you give all this advice, not knowing that they're not you. And so this isn't just doctors. This isn't just healthcare models. It's just how we talk about substances. We kind of assume that if we legislate things in a certain way or talk about things in a certain way, that everyone gets affected a certain way. And nothing could be further from the truth.
What is the ancient for change in this, where we put more of an emphasis on younger individuals so they're prepared for this? Because this would be a very enormous change, and there would be some pushback, and obviously you and many other people believe this is the right way to go. There's all sorts of attention to this, but how do you get more people to buy into these ideas?
Well, our leaders have to help us shape the conversation in that way. And they have to make investments and plant trees that don't bear fruit right away. That's what needs to happen. Because when you start doing prevention programs in schools, which are cost-effective and cheap, but they may not bear fruit for years, you see what I'm saying, until
sure.
kids grow up.
And a lot of these politicians want, number one, let's hope all of them, let's be clear, want help for these individuals. But also, let's be honest, they want to see results so they can go back to their voters and say, look what I did, and this isn't an instant cure.
Yeah, and so they got to have some deliverables, you know, within their election cycle.
Right.
That's true. But we've actually partnered with really good civic leaders. I think Minnesota has a good cadre of leaders. We work with Senator Klobuchar and other people a lot who have, I think, a long lens. And they have a long lens about seeing how this impacts families intergenerationally. And they want to make a difference. And so I think there's enough energy that it's time to have this dialogue. So instead of this generation, we talk about opioids, and the next generation, we talk about some other drug. Let's start talking about people. Let's start talking about how we intervene early, how we prevent this from happening, if at all possible. We have the right kind of dialogue so that we avoid one polarizing argument after another.
Dr. Lee, always appreciate you coming on. Very important information. Thanks for coming on again, and we'll reach out soon.
Great. Thanks again.
Dr. Joseph Lee from Hazelden, Betty Ford, on a very unique idea. And hopefully we look at this and see if this can help, because there's story after story. There's one that I've not discussed on air that was on CBS News yesterday morning about how one area in Ohio is trying to deal with this, and they're trying to be practical about their budget. But it's pretty callous. They keep coming back and saying, financially, what's our alternative? Hopefully we'll get to that tomorrow. A reminder, your Lindus construction time check is 251. Time to install the last roof you'll ever need with GAF asphalt shingles. All right, we got a minute and a half. Jordana next. I could get into the fact that China is very upset with Winnie the Pooh. They're very mad. They claim Winnie the Pooh looks like President Xi. So they're trying to ban Winnie the Pooh.
Because he looks like, oh my.
Yeah, we might have to get Winnie the Pooh on the air. But the one I'll finish with is Kermit. So the guy stepped in for Jim Henson. They dumped him. And they're saying he was a diva. That he didn't want a backup. That he was making money on the side. And he was a pain in the butt to deal with. He's saying this is ridiculous. I don't know what they're talking about. He gave a 45-minute interview. This normally doesn't happen.
45 minutes with the guy that does Kermit?
Was he in the Kermit voice the whole time?
That's not a diva at all.
Yeah. Lisa Henson, who's the president of the Jim Henson Company, he played brinksmanship very aggressively in contract negotiations. And they said enough is enough. I mean, Dan, after you've been Kermit for 27 years, what's your next gig?
I don't know, but I would think that would look awfully good on the resume, wouldn't it? I mean, if you're trying to be a voice actor somewhere and do something, I did Kermit. Where do you go from there?
We have people calling and do various voices. Lindsay, could we get this guy? He needs work. I mean, we're not going to pay him.
I was going to say, we don't really pay.
No, so. We don't pay. You know, we're CCO. Let's see if he can get it done. So the Kermit battle with the Henson Company and Disney still taking place. Have a nice afternoon.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.